The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Heretics Hour, coming to you live on November 19th, 2012. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host for the next 2 hours. I have a great show for you tonight. At least I have enjoyed putting it together. I'm trying to get all the pieces about the protocols of the learned elders of Zion in some kind of order. I want to see if I can find anything missing, or just how leaky the official Jew-created narrative about it is. It's not easy to find something new, but I think I've got some pretty good ideas and some good information in tonight's program, although it's not anything like a smoking gun to get rid of all the detractors of the protocols. But I'm continuing with this, and as I said I would, I'm very interested in it, and I don't have a guest. I'm going to be doing this. I'm just going to be presenting what I have, and I have a lot, but I always worry if I'm going to have enough, but I'll probably not be able to get to it all as I usually do, but we'll see how it goes. I do invite listeners to call in tonight at 1-830-433-4911, although it's better to wait until the second hour so that you see, you know, just what the show is all about and where it's going before you call. But at that time, I would welcome your calls. And I also want to tell you that next week, Tan Stoffel has agreed to be on this program for another progress report. We did one 3 months ago, and we did the first one after 3 months after we started, so I'm hoping to make a tradition of that. And so we will be doing that next Monday. I think you'll probably enjoy that. And this Thursday is Thanksgiving, just a few days from now, and yet Hadding and I will be doing the International Jew as usual. I'm glad we won't be having any breaks in that. However, there won't be any Saturday afternoon show on Saturday, because I am not going to be doing that show through the month of December, and it will start again in January. So I have boldly titled tonight's program is Adolf Kremieu, the author of the protocols. First, let me acknowledge the similarities between the dialogues and the protocols. And for those who might not need to be a little bit refreshed on this, I'm talking not just to the people who are listening right now, and I thank those of you who are listening to me live, so I have somebody that I'm talking to, but also those who will be downloading the show and some of whom may need some background, even though I've gone into this on several previous shows. But of course I don't need to say what the protocols are. I already gave the full name of it, Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. But the dialogues are, what's called both the Geneva Dialogues and, the dialogues from hell or in hell between Machiavelli and Montesquieu by Maurice Joly. And it is claimed, of course, that the protocols are a blatant forgery or plagiarism, a blatant plagiarism of these dialogues by Maurice Joly. Well, I have tried to argue against that, although I have to acknowledge tonight that there are quite a lot of similarities. And for one thing, I'm jumping ahead here again. I hope I don't get in trouble doing that. But I had said in my last full program about the protocols that what they had on Wikipedia as far as three examples of where the two say the same things, and so one is plagiarizing the other, and of course they always make out that it's the protocols that are doing the plagiarizing, that one of the three I couldn't find of what was supposed to be in the dialogue. But I did find it yesterday, looking going over it more carefully. I didn't have enough time before that other program to, I kept going through it, but you know, when you're in a hurry, you miss things. So I will have to correct that both those mentions of Vishnu and his 100 arms or 100 hands, it's different in each one, is mentioned very similarly, both in the protocols and in the dialogues. And the other one was about the interest rates and so on. So now to go on, what I discovered yesterday was that I read the very beginning, the first dialogue. Again, this is Joly's dialogue. It's spelled J-O-L-Y, a Frenchman, Maurice Joly, who wrote this in 1864. Then I went to the protocol number one, or maybe I read protocol number one first, but I said, oh my gosh, these are really very much the same. And I don't, usually they don't point out this part of it, but this is very close. So this is clearly one is copying the other, I think. And so I'm going to read this first part of the dialogue and this first part of the protocol just to be absolutely fair and acknowledge what the problem is here in dealing with the protocol. So in the dialogue number one, it begins, here is how I formulate my system, and I doubt that you can weaken it because it is only made up of deductions from moral and political facts of an eternal truth, colon, you know, that is, bad instincts among men are more powerful than the good ones. I think rather than read the whole thing, I will just read the parts that are going to be the same. So in the dialogue, we have bad instincts among men are more powerful than the good ones. And we have fear and force have more control over him than reason. And then a little ways, it says all men aspire to domination. And there is none who would not be an oppressor if he could, or all or almost all are ready to sacrifice the rights of others for their own interests. This is Machiavelli speaking, you know, the bad guy, the evil one, the harsh one, the repressive dictator one, who is speaking here. And continuing, what restrains the devouring animals that one calls men? At the origin of society, there was brutal and unchecked force. Later, it was the law. That is to say, force still ruled by forms, and political liberty is only a relative idea. The necessity to live is what dominates the states as well as individuals. So when we go to the beginning of the protocol, it says, what I am about to set forth then is our system from the two points. This is the very first protocol, the very beginning. This is how it starts. What I'm about to set forth then is our system from the two points of view, that of ourselves and that of the Goyim. It must be noted that men with bad instincts are more in number than the good, and therefore the best results in governing them are attained by violence and terrorization and not by academic discussions. Every man aims at power. Everyone would like to become a dictator if only he could. And rare indeed are the men who would not be willing to sacrifice the welfare of all for the sake of securing their own welfare. And what has restrained the beasts of prey who are called men? And going on, in the beginnings of the structure of society, they were subjected to brutal and blind force. Afterwards, to law, which is the same force, only disguised. And finally, political freedom is an idea, but not a fact. And it says a little bit more about that. Well, you can see a great similarity there. Obviously, the two writings were, one was familiar with the other, but the question that I'm going to ask, you see, is which came first? Who copied whom? Now, there are people who will say, well, it's obvious, but I'm going to try to make a case here for why it is not obvious. Because I don't think we should just assume that it's obvious, and I think I've got a pretty good case. In fact, apart from this this similarity in the two documents, And the fact that the one by Jolie was written supposedly 30 years before the one that's called The Protocols, which doesn't have an author, anonymous, mysterious. That's really the only thing that would say why it would be, you know, why that would be The Protocols that were doing the copying, and therefore something they call a forgery. So this is what we're going to be looking at here. And the question is, could these two documents even have been somewhat synonymous or written around the same time? Now, the effort has been made by those who seek to dismiss the protocols as fake or as a forgery as simply anti-Semitism. You know, the reason for doing this is anti-Semitism to date the protocols as far later than the Jolie dialogues. What do I mean by that? This is what I'm going to question today, because there is no good proof on either side. Well, there isn't proof on either side. Nobody can prove their case. You have to say, well, one is more convincing to me than the other. We have to look at the arguments offered on each side and consider which is more believable. Now, I'm going to include right here at the beginning what William Pierce said about the protocols in a 30-minute radio broadcast on October 30th, 1999, titled The New Protocols. I listened to that yesterday, took just a few little notes. It's not a real serious broadcast of his, I didn't think. I thought he was kind of having some fun, maybe because it was done the day before Halloween, October 30th, and gives a rather offhand opinion of the protocols. I am quite sure that he has not read Jolie's dialogues, and he didn't even mention them. You know, he doesn't even go in that direction. I don't believe he's ever read the protocols, but he's read about them and he's heard things and he may have looked at them. And, you know, it's a topic that has been a big topic at times. So he's familiar with it. And he thought he would, he came up with this idea for a radio program. And I think, this is what he says in the program. Because he mentions, Henry Ford and says that the only thing Henry Ford ever actually said about him when asked was that they appear to reflect what is actually going on in the world at that time and still today. And he didn't want to say any more. So Pierce said, I will go further and say more than Ford was willing to say. And he said, I think they are not what they purport to be, whatever it is that they purport to be. The problem is they don't really purport to be anything, but people attribute things to what they are supposed to be. Pierce says the text is too straightforward, too open, not deceptive or weasel wordy enough. I'm not quoting him directly. I'm just taking out the, but he didn't say much more than this, but, just taking out some of the main words. He says that Jewish leaders don't use straightforward expressions like encouraging, miscegenation. I don't recall reading that in the protocols, but that doesn't mean it wouldn't be in there somewhere. Because a lot of it I read quite a while back, and now I'm reading some of the later part, and I haven't come across it recently, but I don't remember it, but that's neither here nor there. And he says, and quote, leading the goyim to the slaughter. I don't know that they said that, but they very well could be in there, something like that anyway, often, in fact, many times, something like that. So, Pierce goes on, the top Jews don't talk about what they're up to. Now, if this sounds a lot like Hanning Scott, excuse me, my good friend, it's because this is the same argument that Hanning has presented. Excuse me, I about choked on that. And this is where, you know, he's a great follower of William Pierce, and so he pretty much takes William Pierce's take on it, and has similarly not really gone into studying it. He says he's not too interested in it. So this is, to finish up what Pierce said they use words and phrases. He says they don't talk about what they're really up to. They use words and phrases like building tolerance, building diversity, eliminating inequality. Well, the truth is, they use words like that in the protocols too, but they admit that they're doing it to fool us. You know, I mean, they admit all this in there, but I do not myself think that that this is not the way Jews would talk among themselves. I don't think so, and I don't think that William Pierce knows any better than any other white leader how Jewish leaders talk among themselves, and particularly back then. So, but we'll see. Now, Pierce goes on to say that he would not call it a forgery, however. He believes what he believes, and he uses the word believe. He believes that Nihlus, and we'll talk about him in a bit if you've forgotten who he is. He believes that Nihlus, he's the one who actually published it in Russian in the early 1900s, was a Russian patriot, and Nihlus himself wrote it. Now, not too many people say that Nihlus wrote it. There's not a good case that Nihlus wrote it, but this is what William Pierce is saying. He's saying that he thinks Nihlus wrote it, believing it was an accurate description of what the Jews were doing, but I disagree with that, and I already said how I don't think that Pierce really studied it, and I am discovering how many well-known people and intelligent people and highly respected people will pronounce judgment based on just seeing things somewhere or, you know, that they are convinced by because it sounds reasonable to them. And that's it. And often enough, this information comes from Wikipedia. I'm going to talk about what's on Wikipedia. And they really shouldn't be even having an opinion on it because they don't know enough about it to do so. So I'm trying to learn enough about it. I don't have the great brains of William Pierce and a lot of others. I admit that, but I am trying to learn about it to find out just what could be true and what false. I'm willing to do that. Pierce didn't say that the protocols were wrong in essence. He just didn't think that the Jews themselves wrote it. And that's kind of the way that Hadding comes at it. But I'm not here to talk about Hadding. I don't want to talk about Hadding when he's not here. But I'm just, you know, I think people understand that he has the same views, and largely because they're the views of William Pierce, and that kind of satisfied him. So this is how we get satisfied about things that we really are not too interested in and don't want to look into, but we think we should have an opinion about them. Now, what I feel is that this leaves the protocols in a limbo as a form of anti-Semitism if they weren't written by the Jews, then they were written by some kind of non-Jew. So therefore, you know, the Jews score a big point here, and I never like to see that happen if I can find out that they don't deserve it. And so I've gathered together here tonight what I've learned so far as to who could have written them, because this has never been answered, and no one seems to care about answering it either. You know, the ones who say it's a forgery, they have no idea where it came from. They later on, I'll present some of their what was in that Times of London article, and not very impressive. And we on those who believe the protocols and insist, you know, and a lot of them are not the best people in the world, not people that I have a lot of, I think, are very reliable. People like Henry Mackow and probably Daryl Bradley, you know, Daryl Bradford Smith, probably. I didn't really look on his, but you know, these kind of people will just come right out for it, and they don't really care. They don't have a reputation for caring how much they ignore or how reliable their information is or who they quote or what they say, whether they can prove anything or not. They really don't. So I don't, you know, I find myself on the same side that they are, but they don't have any good reasons for it. So, here I've, you know, I'm just saying that, I'm trying to figure this out. Which most people seem now, there's what is his last name now? I've talked about him too, and all of a sudden I can't think of his last name. I haven't talked to him, and I haven't invited him on as a guest to talk about this. He's done a whole lot of research on this, but he's done a lot of research on a lot of things, so I don't know. I don't know how important it is to him, but he's certainly got pages and pages about it. But I wanted to get it figured out for myself before I talked to him. You know, I mean, I want to get a lot of it, you know, down what I think and what I know. And so I don't want to talk to someone that might be saying this, that, and the other thing. And I couldn't say whether that was, you know, I could agree with that or not. But I will probably, try to get him on the show, one of these days when I'm ready for that. I'm sorry. I can't remember his last name right at the moment. It's German. What I think is that if we don't get this figured out, the protocols are going to go down the memory hole, except for those people who will seem like cultish or ignorant people who are believing in something that they shouldn't believe in, that has no validity, but, you know, they're just stubborn and so on. So I think it's important to do the due diligence on it and to do what is necessary. And I do admire this Peter fellow, whose name I can't remember, for all the work that he's done on it. I may be able to plow through some of that eventually, some more than I already have, but, because there's a ton of material about this. Now, let's start where most people start, with what it says in Wikipedia, because I want to point out some errors in Wikipedia. You know, on that protocols page there, they have a section called creation, and under that, sources for the protocols, or I think that's there, or maybe I wrote that, I don't know, but it says the protocol, they write on, this is taken from there, the protocols is a fabricated document purporting to be factual. It was originally, you know, they don't question that. They don't say, some people think this, some people think that. They have got it down that it absolutely is fabricated. And they say it was originally produced in Russia between 1897 and 1903. See, now that's false. That's a false statement. It was originally published in Russia in 1903 and then a few more times after that. But it wasn't produced. There's a difference there. It actually was produced in France, I'm quite sure. So this is the kind of way, not only Wikipedia, but, you know, see, there's people who do this. They're good at this, and they do it everywhere. I mean, this is the kind of way you see things written so many times. And if you don't know, you just read that, and you take it in, and you don't understand what's wrong with the sentence and why it's, you know, you think, oh, well, okay, that's true. But it's not true. And then the sentence goes on. It was produced possibly by Peter Ivanovich Rachovsky, head of the Paris office of the Russian secret police and unknown others. And then it gives two sources for that information. And the one source is Hans Speyer, who wrote what appears to be an article in Polity, a periodical called Polity, in 1997, titled The Truth in Hell, Maurice Joly on Modern Despotism. And I only could find this particular reference to that. Not that it, I don't think it exists. I think it does exist, but I couldn't get hold of it. I couldn't find it on the internet without doing a real in-depth search, which I'm not too good at anyway. But it's just not something that I could find. But you can imagine that it says something like this. It talks about stuff like this. And then the second one, the source is this New York Times article, not the one in 1920. Well, this is 1921 too, but not the one in the London Times. This is the New York Times that had an article with a long title. Princess, they used to write long titles, like lead-ins to a story or many, many sentences all in the title of the little story there. Princess Radziwill, spelled like Jackie Kennedy's sister used to be. She was Princess Radziwill. Quizzed at a lecture. A stranger questions her title after she had told a forgery of Jewish protocols. Creates stir at Astor. Leaves without giving his name. Mrs. Hurlbut corroborates the princess. Stranger quizzes princess. Corroborates Mademoiselle Radziwill. Never reaches Alexander III. The corroboration period. Says Orgusky was proud of work. That's the end of that story title. This appeared in March 1921. Well, I was able to read that. And, if you have looked at, you find quite a bit written about this Radziwill woman who had a rather bad reputation and actually had been imprisoned for a criminal activity like forging checks. Well, one thing she did, she would go and stay in expensive hotels because she pretended that she was a princess. And then she would leave without paying her bill. She'd run up a great big bill. And then she would leave and they'd be after her. And she would go and do it somewhere else. Well, she just thought she could get away with all this stuff. And then this woman, Mrs. Hurlbut, or sometimes I think it looks like Hurlbut, is just a woman who they brought into this, who is a friend of Princess Radziwill. And she backs up the princess and says what a fine person she is and so on. And she's another mysterious kind of person. She's real, but her background is not anything outstanding. I mean, she doesn't have a criminal background, but she's not anybody important. And yet she's a respectable appearing woman. And so she's there helping out Radziwill. And this Radziwill, in my estimation, is someone that was working for the Jews and doing favors for them because, that's she lives by her wits and so on. And so she agreed to stand, be someone who spoke out about how she knows that the protocols are a forgery and how that came about. She's familiar with Russia and so on. And all of that. So she was going around making a lot of noise at the time. And this one man at this meeting here was trying to ask her a bunch of questions. And then the people there, just like they do at these Holocaust survivor meetings, when you try to question the person, the Holocaust survivor, the people in the audience start yelling at you. They're about ready to throw tomatoes at you. And that's what the people in this meeting did. There are probably a lot of Jews there. And it was in New York. But they start yelling at this man. And, oh, how can you question this woman? She's trying to stand up and tell the truth and look what you're doing. And, they drove him out of there. He finally had to leave. They wanted to know his name, but he never gave it. So this is the kind of thing that was going on in 1921. The protocols was a big, big deal. And there was a lot of controversy, and the Jews were doing everything in their power to brand it as a forgery. So then this Peter Ivanovich Rachovsky, who was mentioned as being possibly one of the producers of the protocols, the writers of it, I guess, head of the Paris office of the Russian secret police. Well, what I learned about him is that he was chief of the Okhrana, which is the secret service in Imperial Russia, or sometimes they call it the secret police, same thing, under the Tsar. He was based in Paris from 1885 to November 1902. So they try to say, well, he could have written it. But that means, I don't know what they're trying to make of that, that he wrote it, that he helped produce it there in Paris, or that he, because he was in Paris, he spoke French and could read French and therefore could copy that French book, the dialogues, and create the protocols. But this is just something that you find in, on Wikipedia to give this, somebody put that in there, you know, one of these people that put things on Wikipedia, and to give an answer for people who might come along there and want to know, you know, want to read about it. But, you know, I don't find any real arguments for this Rachovsky too much, except a little bit in the London Times deal about it, which I'll get to later. If I ever get to it, I'm going kind of slow here. All right, now, well, they say the source material for the forgery, they say that the protocols, this is in Wikipedia still, were taken from both that the dialogues in hell between Machiavelli and Montesquieu, and also a chapter from a book called Biarritz, written by this German novelist Hermann Gerchi, which was, you know, a similar kind of a theme, where Jews were conspiring to do something. This one, I think this was a chapter, it was taking place in a cemetery. But there's a couple of different sources, so I don't remember now, but I've talked about this before. But anyway, there's just one chapter where this, so they say, well, this is what it was stolen from. But this is not, none of this is known, it hasn't been proven, it's just a conjecture, although we do know the similarity with the Joly material. Now, how the protocols got to Russia. I thought that to make this real clear, I should read from the book that I have, the Victor Marsden translation from what Nihilus published. And I don't know which edition this was of Nihilus's publishing. But this is not from the protocols. This is an addition to it, an explanation of how the protocols came to Russia. So in this book, it says, in 1884, the daughter of a Russian general, Mademoiselle Justine Glinka, was endeavoring to serve her country in Paris by obtaining political information, which she communicated to General Orgevsky in St. Petersburg. That is, she was functioning there as in Paris as an agent for the Russian government. There was a lot of this going on, particularly at that time in Paris, because so much was happening in Paris. The person that she gave anything that she learned about was this General Orgevsky, who was in St. Petersburg. And for this purpose, she employed a Jew, Joseph Schorst, who was a member of the Mizraim Lodge in Paris. Now, I'm going to go in quite a bit into the Mizraim Lodge in Paris, and I have talked about it before. It was a kind of a offshoot or part of the big Scottish Rite Temple, but of a more esoteric nature, and this Crémieux was connected with it. But this Joseph Schorst was either, she either employed him or he offered, or she knew him. The thing about him is that, let's see to find that. That's, five. His real name was Shapiro, and he used the name Schorst, which is the German sounding name, but his real name was Shapiro. And his father had been sentenced in London 2 years previously to 10 years penal servitude for counterfeiting. And he was also dealing in things that, you know, to make money on this, you know, dealing, you know, not on the up and up. So this was the kind of family he was. This was the kind of person he was. So even though he was a member of this Mizraim Lodge, which, you know, as a Jew, you could get into all these lodges, and there are a lot of questionable people doing a lot of questionable things, but he was trying to make money on the side through different, you know, through supplying things for a Russian agent. And he told her that he had this document of great importance that he would give to her for 2,500 francs. So, you know, in the security business, there's plenty of money. So she got that money sent to her from St. Petersburg and paid it. And he handed her the document. Now, this they would say is just a story that's been made up. But this doesn't sound, this sounds more believable than the story that is given in London Times expose, what they come up with. I probably am a little biased, but I find this, I've read it quite a few times, and maybe I'm getting used to it, but I don't find it outrageous at all. It sounds very reasonable. She forwarded the French original of this, so she didn't keep the original, but she did have a Russian translation made, and she had several of them. I guess she could copy them or something. She had some copies, and she sent the original and the Russian translation to Orgevsky, and he gave it to his chief, General Sherovin. This would be in the security department, and he was supposed to give it to the Tsar, but Sherovin was under obligation to wealthy Jews, which is also very understandable. So many people were. And so he was supposed to be kind of looking out for the Jews' interests in his position. So he didn't transmit it, but he filed it in the archives. And in the meantime, Glinka was called back to Russia. I won't say for what reasons. It doesn't really matter. And she took a copy. She kept a copy of the Russian translation of this thing. And when she got back there, she gave it to this man, Alexis Sukhotin, who is a responsible man, who everybody, you know, he had a position and so on. He wasn't a nobody, somebody that she knew. She was not a nobody either. And Sukhotin then showed the document to two friends, Stepanov and Nilus, or maybe it's Nilus. I think it should be Nilus, but I don't know. Now, Stepanov had it printed and circulated privately in 1897. So that would have been the first that it was circulated. And the other man, Sergius Nilus, who was a real, he was a religious man. He was in a religious order of some kind. Or he was just staying in one. He published it in 1903. It says in here in 1901, but in other places it's 1903. So I think that I will go with the 1903. And he published it in a book entitled The Great Within the Small. And that book did actually come out, and it was in there. These protocols were in there. And at the same time, or around that same time, in 1906, another Russian, a friend of Nihilus, whose name is also Nihilus. No, a friend of Nihilus, G. Butmi, also published it, and he deposited a copy of it in the British Museum in 1906. And that's known that it's there. It's been there since then. And so that's all true. Now, this Stepanov, who we're talking about, who received the one of the copies from Sukhotin, and he wrote out in longhand, he wrote out a statement, long one, that of what happened. I can't read it. It's in German, or else it's in French, or it's in something else. I can't tell what it's in because it's written so funny, but it's got like a seal on it, and it's signed, and it tells you, there's an English translation that says what he says here. He said, in 1895, my neighbor in the district of Tula, Alexis Sukhotin, he was a retired major, gave me a manuscript, copy of the Protocols of the Wise Men of Zion. He told me that a lady of his acquaintance, whose name he did not mention, residing in Paris, had found it at the house of a friend, a Jew. Well, easily that they could have said that. Either she would say she found it there rather than that he stole it and gave it to her. Before leaving Paris, she had secretly translated it and had brought this one copy to Russia and given it to Sukhotin. Then he says, at first I mimeographed this translation, but finding it difficult to read, I resolved to have it printed, making no mention of the date, town, or printer's name. In this I was helped by Arkady Ippolitovich Kelepovsky, who at that time was chief of the household of Grand Duke Sergius, the different Sergius, Grand Duke. He gave the document to be printed by the district printing press. This took place in 1897. Sergius Nihilus, the one that the main guy here, inserted the protocols into his work and added his own commentary. And it's signed Philip Petrovich Stepanov, formerly procurator of the Synod of Moscow, chamberlain, privy councillor, and in 1897, chief of the Moscow Kirk Railway in the town of Orel, April 17th, 1927, he wrote this out, you know, when all this controversy was going on. And it was witnessed by Prince Dmitry Galitzin, and who is president of the Russian colony of emigrants at Stary Fontag. So this man did try to, he was not a nobody, and he did try to do something with this, and then he wrote this out to tell people that he did actually do this. So this is a whole lot more than you're going to find about the other theory of how this protocols came about. And I think it's pretty good. Now, a little bit more here, let's see how important it is, just that there's a paragraph in here. The next paragraph after about the British Museum, it says, meantime, through Jewish members of the Russian police, minutes of the proceedings of the Basel Congress in 1897 had been obtained, and these were found to correspond with the protocols. Now, the footnote for through Jewish members, number 10, says, notably, Eno Azev and Ephraim. The latter, formerly a rabbi, died in 1925 in a monastery in Serbia, where he had taken refuge. He used to tell the monks that the protocols were but a small part of Jewish plans for ruling the world and a feeble expression of their hatred of the Gentiles. Well, that's not important. What's important is that it says through Jewish members of the Russian police. So they named two of them, and one of them is a rabbi, but he turned Christian and died in a monastery in Serbia. I don't know anything, you know, I don't think that is, well, whatever part that plays, it says that these were Jewish members of the Russian police, and they, through them, it says minutes of the proceedings of the Basel Congress in 1897 had been obtained. Okay, so we know that there was a Basel Congress in 1897, and we know that there would have been minutes, but it doesn't say that these were the minutes, because it goes on to say, and these were found, that is, the minutes of the Basel Congress were found to correspond with the protocols. Now, that has the footnote 12, and it says, the Russian government had learned that at meetings of the B'nai B'rith in New York in 1893 and 94, Jacob Schiff had been named chairman of the Committee on the Revolutionary Movement in Russia. Now, this doesn't say that this does not at all say, I had to go over this quite a few times to say, what the heck are they trying to say here? And why is this in here? Well, they're just trying to give some credibility. They're just trying to connect. What they're trying to do is connect the protocols with what happened in Russia. These are Russian people. You know, what happened in their country with the revolution and all. And so all they're saying here, this little paragraph has been misinterpreted, because if people take this to mean that it is saying that the protocols made up the minutes of the Basel Congress in 1897. And in truth, as I look and look from the people who would be on the side of the protocols, that has never been said. It has never been said, and yet it's repeated by a lot of people. And this is one area, because to find that in this book, which is the book that's supposed to be, you know, the truth of things, you know, was kind of shocking. And I thought, well, what the heck? But now as I really looked at it, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say anything. It doesn't say that the protocols were a part of the Basel Congress. It just says that what was talked about, and that Jacob Schiff, you know, was involved in the revolution in Russia. Jacob Schiff from New York, the Jew. And this corresponds with the protocols. That's what it says. This is what the whole argument about the value of the protocols is. It's that it corresponds with what is actually happening. And that's all they're saying here. So, we can throw out altogether this. If anybody says to you, well, they claimed that these were the minutes of that meeting and they weren't, and how can you prove that? I don't think they were. You can just tell them that's a total misunderstanding, and nobody's ever claimed, nobody responsible has ever claimed, and neither does this book claim that these were the minutes of that Zion. That was the first Zionist Congress, held in Basel, Switzerland in 1897. Okay. Now, Nihlus published several editions of this book, of The Great Within the Small, and in 1917, he prepared a, okay, I got that wrong. He put that one out in 1903. All right, then in January 1917, he prepared a second edition, and he had revised and documented it and so on. But before it could be put on the market, the revolution of March 1917 had taken place. And Kerensky had succeeded to power, and he ordered the whole edition of Nihlus's book to be destroyed. Now, Nihlus's book was known in Russia, that's all that time. Not that it was a big seller or anything, but once the Tsar was deposed, then Kerensky ordered all of those books to be destroyed. And so in 1924, he was arrested by the Cheka and imprisoned and tortured. And after the second edition, I think he put out a few more editions too. And one of them was, this gets kind of long, one of them was had a different name to it, a little bit different. He was very adamant, worked very hard at doing this. He really believed in it. And that's why some people will say that he wrote, it was his. It was his work, and he was writing it to try to save his country. Okay, that is how the protocols got to Russia. I think I will go right now and compare this to what is in, I think that's a good idea. I have to come way down here and compare this to what is in the London Times by, let me get to the right place here. Oh, Philip Graves. Philip Graves was that correspondent for the Times in Constantinople, who says that, this is his story, which came out in 1921. A few months ago, Mr. X brought a number of old books from a former officer of the Okhrana, the political police of Russia, the Tsarist Russia, who had fled to Constantinople. So here we've got a Mr. X, and supposedly he bought some books from an unknown officer in the Okhrana who had fled to Constantinople. So that's how they got into Constantinople. Among these books, or Mr. X got them there, among these books was a small volume in French, and then it goes into a lot of detail of describing this book and ends up saying that Mr. X believes it must be rare, since had it not been so, the protocols would have speedily been recognized as a plagiarism by anyone who had read the original, because it was Mr. X that told this Philip Graves that here's a big one for you. Look here, look at this book, and you find out that this is where the protocols came from. So the protocols are proven to be a forgery. And that would have been quite convincing and quite devastating. And so, easy to believe, that's for sure. So the old Okhrana officer, Graves goes on to write, the old Okhrana officer did not remember where he obtained it, the book, and attached no importance to it. And Mr. X, who had bought the book, glanced at it one day and was struck by a resemblance they put that in there because they don't have any answer to where it came from. How did this Mr. X get hold of this book? Well, he got it from this officer, but the officer, they have to say the officer didn't remember where he got it. So Mr. X, glancing at it one day, was struck by a resemblance between the passage, in the French edition of the protocols and there, and he followed up by checking it out and soon realized that the protocols were to a very large extent as much a paraphrase of the Geneva original. They call it the Geneva dialogues often. That's what they're talking about, the dialogues in hell. And then he says, before receiving the book from Mr. X, he said, I did not believe that Nihilus's protocols were authentic. They explained too much by the theory of a vast Jewish conspiracy. Well, that sounds like someone working for the Jews. They say, well, they don't, it's all just conspiracy talk in there, which is really not true. But, and then he says Professor Nihilus's account of how they were obtained was too melodramatic to be credible. Well, I just read to you Professor Nihilus's account of how they were obtained. So you have to decide whether it was melodramatic or not. It really wasn't melodramatic, but this, what he is giving here, in my opinion, is too empty of any drama. It's too empty of any feeling. It doesn't contain anything that is convincing. It's just a story saying there's this Mr. X who, although this Mr. X was later identified, and I talked about that too in another program, but I'm not going to talk about it again now. In the London Times, it goes on to say the Geneva book, the Geneva book, the original, is a very thinly veiled attack on the despotism of Napoleon III in the form of a series of 25 dialogues divided into four parts. That is true. And it is Machiavelli represents the cruel despotism that the writer Joly wants to convince people that is the way Napoleon III is and the way his rulership will be. The Times article goes on to say there is no evidence as to how the Geneva dialogues reached Russia. Well, that says a lot right there. He has to add in here, I guess, that there's no evidence as to how they got to Russia. We've said all this is just a speculation. But we don't know. So, this is an important point because, they want to say that most want to say that the that the protocols were written in Russia, but because they don't want them to be written in France, but they were written in France, and they're written in French, as that story about Mademoiselle Glinka has it, and that and when they were written is not known. Now, the Napoleon's secret police, they say in the London Times, many of whom were Corsicans, must have known the existence of the dialogues. Well, here, see here, they're trying to explain it. Must have known the existence of the dialogues and almost certainly obtained them from some of the many persons arrested on the charge of political conspiracy during the reign of Napoleon III. Well, you know, all of that is basically accurate, and it could, you know, but it doesn't explain, that doesn't mean that that these Corsicans brought this book to Russia either. He says it's not improbable that Corsicans who had been in the service of Napoleon, who had been kinsmen in the Secret Service, brought the Geneva Dialogues to Russia. Well, they just say it's not improbable. They don't say that it actually happened. And then they say that they talk about the history of Nihilus publishing his book and the name of it and so on, and where it came from, so we know all that. And they say that in the one is struck by the absence of any effort on the part of the plagiarist to conceal his plagiarisms. Now, I found this a really important statement put out by the London Times by this Graves fellow, their correspondent, saying that when you compare the protocols to the Geneva Dialogues, you're struck by the absence of any effort on the part of the plagiarist to conceal his plagiarisms. I'm going to explain why this is important when I get back after this 5-minute break, and I hope you'll stay with me.
Dieser Tage, an die wir bei Oma sind. Es duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Oma erzählt, sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gabst dein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Erzählt von einer Zeit für uns unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt. Du warst ein guter Mann, die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager with the Heretics Hour on November 19th, 2012. I'm talking about the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. And I have a lot I want to get into this next hour, so I'm going to get right to it. And I do want to tell you that I do plan to get this all together in writing, and probably in December. We'll have to do it then. Get it on my blog, and as a blog on the White Network and so on. Because it's an awful lot to follow just listening. Now this idea that that they admit this Graves, keep forgetting his first name. I want to call him Philip for some reason, but it's not Philip. I keep having to go up and look for it. It is Philip. Oh yeah, it is Philip Graves. Okay, Philip Graves. He makes the point in the Times article. It was an article that ran for 3 days. So they did part of it and then more of it and then more of it. We're down towards the end of it now. And he says, you're struck by the absence of any effort of the plagiarist to conceal his plagiarism. Well, it's true, because as I read to you the very beginning of both of them, and how all the similarity in what was said, the kind of words used and so on. And the same way with these three examples that are at Wikipedia, very similar. You would say, well, that is actually an argument for the fact that it was the, whoever plagiarized from the other one was not concerned with being caught, was not concerned with the plagiarism being found out. And that fits with the idea that it was that the protocols were no that the yeah that Jolie let me get this straight that Jolie was copying from documents that were provided to him, which were in fact what turned out what are the protocols, and which were never going to see the light of day, which he wasn't told were going to see the light of day, so he could just take stuff from them as he wished, without worrying about it. And this is going to come out as we move along here, and I'll try to make a real good point of that. Let me go on and say that I already said that. The rest of this New York Times, London Times article. I don't know if I need to. There's 4 points here that they were designed to foster the belief that the prime cause. Oh, here's one. The first one was that they say that they point out at the end of this London Times article that the protocols are largely a paraphrase of the book here provisionally called the Geneva Dialogues. Well, they're not largely a paraphrase. It's true that there's a lot of similarities, but they're not largely. The Geneva Dialogues had a very different purpose and have a whole lot of stuff in them that's not in the protocols, and same way with a lot in the protocols, not anything like what's in the Geneva Dialogues. It's just parts of it that are used. And that fits into my theory, too. Now, the second point they make was that the protocols were designed to foster the belief that the prime cause of discontent among the politically minded elements in Russia was not the repressive policy of the bureaucracy, the bureaucracy of the Tsar and his repressive policies, but was a worldwide Jewish conspiracy. See, and they thus served as a weapon against the Russian liberals, who urged the Tsar to make certain concessions to the intelligentsia. Well, so they say that the purpose of the protocols was to blame the to take the blame away from the Tsar, where it belonged, for the revolution and his bad policies, and put it on the Jews. But you see, we know who would come up with this. This is what the Jews would, you know, the Jews want to say, well, we had nothing to do with this. This was, the people revolted because of the bad policies of the Tsar, and that's why this big revolution took place. We know that's not true. So right there, you can see that the London Times and Hugh Graves are working for those who are promoting the interests of the Jews and the way the Jews want things to be seen. Now, the third point is that the protocols were paraphrased very hastily and carelessly. Well, they were either hastily and carelessly, or they were just taken because they weren't the other, what it was taken from, was not ever going to be known. That is, the Jolie was copying from what is known as the protocols, which I already said. And then the fourth point is, portions of the protocols were probably supplied portions of the protocols that don't come from the Geneva Dialogues, which is quite a lot, were probably supplied by the Okhrana, which organization very possibly obtained them from the many Jews it employed to spy on their co-religionists. So here they're trying to again involve the Okhrana, the Russian secret police. But they're also trying to say that, okay, so they got stuff, they know stuff about Jews, and but there are all these Jews that were employed to spy on their fellow Jews, and they're these, you know, bad Jews, and it was really the fault of the secret police who you know, either got these Jews to do this and so on. So again, it's this pro-Jewish propaganda that's coming out of this article from the New York, from the London Times in 1921. Okay, now I'm going to, I got that taken care of now, so I'm going to go back to where I was, and see, I said that was a good place to go and read that, the source material, how the protocols got to Russia. Okay, we took care of that. Now, I'm sorry. I mean, I had this so that I could just get around in it real easily, but I kind of threw myself off. Now I got to go through all this stuff, which I'm not going to talk about, and talk about Jolie and this man named Adolf Kremieu, who I put in the title as being the author of the protocols. So Jolie's Dialogues come out in 1864. And so now I'm going to go to where I wrote about that. I find that single asterisk. Oh, my. Why does this happen to me every time? No, I passed it by. I'm just going to... where is it? Jolie. I was going to tell you about some things about Jolie. That's that. Like, once I get a plan, I can't change it very easily. This is the Rite of Mizraim. Here it is. Okay. Jolie wrote the dialogues, you know, in hell between Machiavelli and Montesquieu. And this, what he wrote as a kind of a pamphlet, they call them pamphlets, but it's very long, as you know, as long as a book, but they still call them pamphlets. He published it anonymously in Brussels in 1864. This date is so important, and I'll be able to say why. The introduction ends... the introduction up to the book, you know, that he wrote, ends Geneva. He signs it Geneva, October 13th, 1864. So that's why the Times calls it the Geneva Dialogues. A lot of people called it that because it was written in Geneva or signed off in Geneva, and which is a part of Switzerland, you know. But Switzerland has a French part to it and so on. So it's kind of considered part of France. Anyway, it was soon discovered by the police that this book was soon discovered, even though he published it anonymously. See, he hoped not to be associated with it because he knew that it was dangerous because it was very it was political satire aimed at Napoleon III, and it was pretty easy to tell that that's what it was about. It was supposed to be known that that's what it was about. So he didn't want to be. He didn't want it known that he wrote it, but I think somebody who wanted it to be known let that information out, and he was arrested, and he was tried and sentenced to 2 years imprisonment in 1865, the following year. And it was said that he had written his book as an attack against the government of Napoleon III, which he had. And... thanks to his maternal grandfathers, there's a bunch here about his mother. His mother was of Corsican descent and Roman Catholic. Her father had an inveterate hatred of Napoleon I. You know, the Italians and I guess the Corsicans especially really hated Napoleon I. And Jolie's father was a Norman, regular Frenchman, but he had a comfortable fortune. Jolie was not, you know, from a poor family, from a good family, and his family, from a Masonic family. And thanks to his maternal grandfather's, especially his Masonic association, but his father was also a Mason, which we'll see in a minute. Jolie was able to secure a post in the Ministry of the Interior in 1851, just before 1851, under this M. Chevreau, and but surprisingly, he was studying law, but he found supposedly that he wrote some articles and he showed some talent. So in 1860 already, he terminated his law studies. Now this is important too about Jolie. He terminated his law studies and He founded a paper or a periodical called Le Palais for lawyers and attorneys. And the principal stockholders were six men. And one of them was Adolphe Grémieux. So the question here, if you can keep it in mind, is why in 1860, and another one of these men was Arago, who's going to come up later. Why in 1860 did Jolie decide to terminate his studies? He was only 29 at that time, 29 years old, and decide to do this magazine? Because in 1864, this Dialogues came out, all right? So now a little bit about Jolie before we go back to Crémieux. Jolie was a socialist. He wrote of himself, I'm not going to say all that, he wrote some stuff about why he's a socialist, how he hated, he rejected communism, but he liked socialism. That means he was in with the Masons, and he was basically, you know, a liberal Masonic type thinker, but he didn't like communism. But he said that he was a Jacobin. Now, Jacobins at that time, generally a Jacobin is someone who supports a centralized republic with power made at the federal level. But and during the French Revolution, the term was popularly applied to all supporters of revolutionary opinions. So the Jacobins were kind of the opposition to monarchies and empires. And more specifically, it was used to describe members of the Jacobin Club, which was a revolutionary far-left political movement that had had been the most famous political club during the French Revolution. And he, Joly, identified himself as a Jacobin. And he was a friend of Adolphe Cremieux, as we will see, particular part of the relationship. He shared, they shared hatred of Napoleon III. Cremieux originally was a loyalist to Napoleon III, but when Napoleon III was got into power, he didn't give Cremieux, I talked about this before, the position that Cremieux wanted, which was going to give him the influence to help the Jews and to do the kind of things he wanted to do. And he was so angry about that that he became a real opponent of Napoleon III and really worked against him. And so Joly and he had this in common right at the same time in the 60s, 1860s. And, okay, so back to Cremieux. Now, Cremieux was born Isaac Moshe in Nimes to a wealthy Jewish family in 1796. Now, I say here that as far as being the author of the protocols, Cremieux is one of the best suspects for that because he had the status and he had the opportunity. Now, he had the status from 1834 until his death in 1871, that's almost 40 years, he served as vice president of the Consistoire Central des Israelites de France, I shouldn't even bother with that. He the Central Consistory of the Jews of France, which was the administrative agency for all French Jews. And I think he was vice president because the head of it always had to be a rabbi. I don't think he was a rabbi. But I want to tell you a little bit about what the consistory is. If I can get, here it is. The first attempt to create such a consistory was made by Napoleon I. You know, I think you might be familiar with the fact that that Napoleon convened the Assembly of Jewish Notables in 1806. And it was... they passed some resolutions and it was confirmed by a grand Sanhedrin that he also had convened. And by 1888, he had organized this thing called a consistory. And according to it, every department containing 2,000 Jews could establish a consistory in their, what they call department is like a district of the country. And if they didn't have that many Jews, then they could join with another district that didn't have that many Jews and make up their own consistory, one consistory. And above all these provincial consistories, there was a central consistory, and that's what Cremieux was head of all those years. And every one of them consisted, the provincial consistories consisted of a grand rabbi with another rabbi where possible and three lay members, two of whom were residents of the town where the consistory sat. And they are elected by 25 notables, and the eligible members were Israelites. They like to call themselves Israelites, who had reached the age of 30 years, had never been bankrupt, and had not practiced usury. Well, these were Napoleon's rules. See, Napoleon wanted to make these Jews in France into a responsible group of French people. And one of the questions he had asked them was, you know, do you believe that that Jews are French or are not, or however he worded that, and the Jews all said, oh, yeah, no, we think we're French. We believe we're French. Of course, they lied. They always lie. They don't have any problem doing that. And so he wanted to kind of stop them from practicing usury, and he wanted them to take up some, make sure that some Jews took up mechanical occupations or, you know, became mechanical trades, and that no one evaded the military service. That these Jews running these consistories, these rabbis should see to it that no Jews evaded the military service, which was important to Napoleon. But, you know, here he was. He was dealing with people, as we always find, that he thought he could trust. But, of course, he can't. He couldn't. But they got what they wanted. And, you know, another thing that I remembered, speaking about these consistories, was that I talked about the Scottish Rite Temple in my hometown, and I remember today that that's what we called it. We called it the Consistory. It was kind of a big building, and it was kind of very placed. We're very very easily seen, and so on. Kind of a landmark, and different things took place there. But that's what it was always called, the Consistory. So that's a connection between the French consistory system and the Scottish Rite lodges. Now, a part of this that's important to know, if I can squeeze this in here, is that the central consistory of French Jews still exists, and it's still powerful, and it's and that France's Jewish community is the largest in Europe today, and it was large then. But it is about 500,000 as of 2010, 500,000 Jews in France. That's the largest outside of the United States and Israel. And yet the United States is 5 million. Actually, in the U.S. Census Bureau of 2008, it was 6.5 million. So I don't know. Somebody called it over 5 million, but it's the U.S. Census Bureau said 6.5 million. 2.2% of the population in the United States. And in Israel, it's about 5.5 million or something like that, estimated. So even though that might be a pretty good number, part of the population in France, it sure doesn't even come close to what we have as Jews in the United States. We are equal to Israel, so the Jewish homelands are Israel and the United States. But Jews have always been in France in larger numbers than in other European countries. So that's that. Now, this coming back to Crémieux and his positions, in Paris, he became a brilliant defender of liberal ideas in the law courts. You know, he was born to a wealthy family. He was well-educated. He was supposed to be brilliant, and he had this brilliant career, and he was a defender of liberal ideas, and he was a staunch defender of human rights of the Jews of France. And as I said, he was the head of this consistory for all those years. So 40 years, they thought that he was the one that should do it. He was held that highly. And that means that was the main organization of Jews in France, apart from this new one that he helped to found. And so he was it in France as far as the Jewish, elitism goes. And, he was elected a deputy to the federal government, I guess, in 1842, and he was one of the leaders in the campaign against the Guizot ministry, and his eloquence contributed greatly to the success of his party. So he was very eloquent, and he was a great thinker, and he was somebody who could certainly write those protocols. Now, in 1842, as Minister of Justice, He secured the decrees abolishing the death penalty for political offenses. This is all stuff that Jews have on their agenda. You know, liberalizing and abolishing the death penalty for political offenses, because they commit a lot of political offenses, and making the office of judge immovable. I don't know what that accomplished, but the same year he was instrumental in declaring an end to slavery in all the French colonies. So, you know, he was called the Abraham, since then, I don't know when, he's called the Abraham Lincoln of France or something. And he supported, at first, Louis Napoleon, as I said. But when, supposedly, when he discovered the Louis Napoleon's imperial ambitions, he broke with him. But it really was because he didn't get the position he wanted after Louis Napoleon took power. So another, also how highly he's thought of among Jews is that a street is named after him in Jerusalem as well as in Tel Aviv and Haifa. And now in Freemasonry, he was the Grand Master of the Scottish Rite Lodge after being involved in the Rite of Mizraim. Now, I'm going to say a little bit about Mizraim here. That's the consistory. Okay, the Rite of Mizraim, M-I-Z-R-A-I-M, was founded in 1805. And this rite had 90 degrees. It was actually considered a more esoteric offshoot, not so much an offshoot, but part of the Scottish Rite. It was separate, but not so separate. Part of it, real elitism, a real elite lodge, with 90 degrees, and it was founded by, in Milan, by four men with French names, one of which is Joly, R. Joly, probably his father, or his grandfather, 1805, hard to tell. And it was introduced into France in 1816. Of course, there's other Joly, so it might not be him. It might not be his family. It might be some kind of relative. I can't say. But anyway, that was one of the founders. Joly was one of the founders of the Mizraim Lodge. And it says in the Mizraim, the trials of initiation were long and difficult. And they were founded on what is recorded in the Egyptian and Eleusinian mysteries. And Heckethorn states that this rite is essentially autocratic, there being no obligation on the Grand Master to account for his actions. Well, we know that the protocols of the elders talk a lot about autocracy and that their leader, their great leader, when he appears and comes into his power, is going to be an autocrat. And the protocols have been said to have been archived in this lodge, this Mizraim Lodge in Paris. And that's where they were taken from by this Joseph Schorst, who was a member of this lodge. And and at this lodge, there was said that there was no obligation on the Grand Master to account for his actions. Well, Cremieux was not, I guess, ever the Grand Master of this lodge. He was the Grand Master of the Scottish Rite, but he was active in this lodge, it is said in several accounts. But there's no, you know, I don't know that there's there's no lists or you know, official lists of who was a part of what when it comes to things like this. So you just have to go by that. So I see this as a strong connection or another connection between this lodge and the protocols. And because there are several connections between this lodge and the protocols. And this is another one. And for those who say that Jews don't like autocracy, that depends on which Jews you're talking about, because some of these Freemasons, that certainly is their plan. That certainly is what they like. Now, And this Mizraim Lodge was essentially Jewish, it says. And, it is said that the protocols were brought to light from taken from this Jewish Lodge of Mizraim in Paris in 1884. I already said all that. And this Joseph Schwartz, alias, what was that alias of his? I've got it already. Shapiro, I think. Was later murdered in Egypt after he delivered a copy of the protocols or something to Glinda. And it is true, though, it's that the next year or so he was murdered in Egypt. He went to Egypt and he was found murdered. So make of that what you will. Now I'm going back to Nilus here. I don't want to go back to that at the moment. So I will come back up to, that was about the Mizraim Lodge. Okay. He had the status. He had the eloquence. All right. Okay. Now he had the opportunity. Adolf Cremieux. This great man, this great French Jew. He was imprisoned by Napoleon III in 1851 for a short time because he became an enemy of the emperor. And Jolie, you know, had also been imprisoned. But he then went into private, but that was later. But he then went into private life. He remained in private life until November 1869. So from around 1852 or so, let's say, until 1869, he wasn't participating in public politics. So he practiced law and minded his own business. So at that time, he could have been working out, he could have been writing the protocols. You know, he was working out his revenge for one thing. They say he was very revengeful towards Napoleon III. He was working against him quite a bit, but not so much that he would get arrested and put in prison again. And, behind the scenes. Now, this fits very perfectly with Maurice Joly because this was his situation until 1869. And we know that Joly, from 51 or 52 to 69, that's a long time. We know that Joly, quit his law studies in 1860, and then he started this periodical, of which Cremieux was one of the stockholders. So they knew each other, and they were probably working together, and it may be that Cremieux had a lot to do with Joly's decision to quit his law studies and start writing, because that was in 1860, and in 1864, he had written this Dialogues, which were an attack against Napoleon III, which was right in line with what Cremieux wanted to accomplish. So let me continue here. Now, in 1860, also, while Cremieux was not involved in the political life of France, you know, he was out of favor. He was opposed to who was in control, who was running the nation then. He founded the Alliance Israelite Universelle in Paris. This was in 1862. Also, I should say, not 1860, 1860 also. This is a very famous group, famous Jewish international group. And which would really be called in English the Jewish Universal Alliance. That's what it was. It was a Jewish Universal Alliance. And the general idea of that is that they felt at that time that they could come out. They were strong enough, the Jews. They could come out openly and say that they were they call it universal, but really an international group. They were Jews all around the world. were to join this, were to belong to this, because they were an internet, they were a nation. They had their own group. You know, they were, this is the first time that they had felt confident enough to say, we are a people. We are loyal to one another. We are all one, and we ally together. We are an alliance from all around the world. And this is what this was. And Cremieux was one of the main founders of it. He wasn't the only one, but it was founded in 1860, and Cremieux became president of it in 1864. That's the year Joly's Anonymous Dialogues came out. He became president in 1864, and he remained president, again, I think, for the rest of his life, you know, or a long time. I've got that somewhere, but he just stayed in there. He continued, and that was a big position for him. I mean, he was very important, influential Jew, very high, very much an elite, one of the most elitist Jews. And I don't know if I'll get back to this, but I might come up to this again. But when he later on when the Scottish Rite Lodge emerged with the Grand Orient, because he was in both of them, but he was a Grand Master of the Scottish Rite. But I think he became Grand Master after they merged, and this fellow who was the Grand Master died, and then it went to Cremieux. So that was a huge position, very influential also, and very secretive, because, you know, in a lodge like that, you're doing all of this Masonic world control stuff. I mean, that's actually is what goes on there. I mean, that's what they're doing, trying to take over nations, trying to destabilize. They were behind the French Revolution. You know, they were involved in the Russian Revolution. They're always doing that. They're trying to destabilize all these nations. So he was doing that, and so he had an association or a friendship maybe with Joly, and that was probably partly why Joly started up this magazine and started writing, and he was writing this book, The Dialogues, which was to be a pamphlet. Cremieux would have been very likely helping him with it. How would he help him with it? He would help him with it by showing him these protocols that he had, that maybe he had written, or maybe he had enlarged upon, or maybe he had something to do with them, or maybe they were just in his keeping and he knew about them. Whatever, he thought that he would show these to Joly to help him write this, because he wanted him to write this thing against him. That, you know, there were some good ideas in there. And that's why it wasn't covered up. It wasn't, nobody, they didn't care. He didn't care whether he just copied from it, because he was told that he could, because they weren't supposed to ever see the light of day. So, just some little details about Cremieux, which I won't distract you with. So let's look at this. I've got a little timeline here. In 1851, Cremieux becomes an opponent of Napoleon III. Before that, he was a great friend and an ally, and knew all the family, and, you know, was working, had a position in the government and so on. Well, then he becomes an opponent, and he retires from public life until 1869. From 1851 to 1869, of course, he was arrested for a little while, but then he was able to go to his big estate and stay there. That's 18 years. What was he doing all that time? Well, I say he could have been writing the protocols and doing all kinds of other work, you know, that to undermine everything that was going on, make it more favorable for the Jews. And in 1860, then, Joly quits his law studies. starts up a periodical for lawyers and jurists and is funded by a group of six, which includes Crim U. In 1864, Joly publishes the pamphlet Dialogues of Geneva anonymously. He doesn't want it known that he wrote that because he's going to get in trouble with the government of Napoleon III for sure. So he was assured that he wouldn't get in trouble, and that's why he did it. But somehow somebody told on him, and some people think it was done because they always were going to, because they wanted it to be known who wrote it, because he was a prominent attorney. Joly was, prominent enough. But anyway, he's arrested and he's imprisoned for a while. It says he was sentenced to 2 years, so maybe he was in prison for 2 years. But now the book is out and, the dialogue is out and people have it. And in 1870, the rule of Napoleon III ends. And so Joly is back in business again, and Crim U is back again, doing all kinds of stuff and getting involved in politics. And the last person, the last thing I'm going to talk about is the Venedi book, which is mentioned sometimes. But it is not, it has not been brought out as being a part of one of the sources for the protocols. But it is, it could be, because, let's see where that starts. Okay. Long before Marie Joly's book, Dialogues book, came out, another book, this came out bearing much the same title, published in Berlin in 1850. So this was 14 years before Joly's book came out. In 1850 in Berlin, it was called Machiavelli, Montesquieu, Rousseau by Jacob Venedi, and was published, in Berlin. Venedi was a Jew born in Cologne in 1805. Owing to his revolutionary activities, he was expelled from Germany and sought refuge in France. While living in Paris in 1835, he edited a paper of subversive character called Les Proscrits, and it caused the police to send him away from Paris, and he then lived in Le Havre. But due to the intercession of Arago, which is one of Joly's stockholders in his magazine, what I mentioned his name before, with Crim U, Arago was one of that six, and due to the intercession of this person, probably a Jew too, probably they were all Jews, these people were friends of Adolf Crim U, it says in this write-up, that this Arago and Mignet were friends of Adolf Crim U, and so they would have known Joly too, because he was a stockholder in Joly's magazine company. So, who are we talking about now? Venedi. Venedi was once more allowed to return to Paris. And he had published a book himself, which was praised, by the French Academy. And it was called, Romanism, Christianity, and Germanisme. I don't know how you translate that, but Germanism, I guess. Romanism, Christianity, and Germanism, or Christianism. Anyway, he was a talented guy, but a Jew and a real leftist. He was a close friend and associate of Karl Marx. He had spent the years between 1843 and 1844 in England with Marx, In 1847, he and Marx, he went with Marx to Brussels, and they founded there the secret organization called the Communist League of Workers, which was eventually brought out into the open under the name of the International Society of Democracy. That's how they do these things. This is how the whole protocols thing works, They fool you by, they try to get all this stuff, they give it these names, International Society of Democracy, really a communist league of workers. And so Venedi returned to Germany in the company of Karl Marx still, and he became one of the chiefs of the Revolutionary Committee of 50, organized in 1948 in Germany. And it was at this time that he published his book, Machiavelli, Montesquieu, and Rousseau, and it says here, upholding the ideas of Machiavelli and Rousseau for the slavery and demoralization of the people. Now, I'm not sure if this is kind of tongue-in-cheek. They're upholding the ideas of these two men who were anti-imperialists, anti-monarchists. There's a lot of difference, though, between Machiavelli and Rousseau. But Rousseau was also for a great deal of, he was actually for a great deal of freedom, and Machiavelli was for using terror to not allow people to be free. So, but somehow they're linked together, and the idea of really for not demoralizing the people, although it's not supposed to be seen that way, people are supposed to fall for it and agree with it, and then they'll end up demoralized and enslaved. I think that's how it works. But here's what we say here, that Jacob Venedi, his work was showing Machiavelli and Rousseau as that of their policies as that of triumphant communism. And Maurice Joly's book about Machiavelli shows Machiavelli, Machiavelli's policy of reaction and imperialism. So what we've actually got here is that whether you are preaching reaction and imperialism or you're preaching communism, it can all end up the same. I mean, it can all be the same. And Adolf Cremieux was connected with all the parties, and he had connections everywhere. He actually helped form this alliance, this Jewish Universal Alliance, which was the center of what united all these parties, all these groups, the communists, you know, the Jews, excuse me, the revolutionaries, the extremists, you know, all the people that were unhappy, the Marxists, etc. This Israelite Universal Alliance was, in fact, the central cajal, it said, for universal Jewry. So behind all this stuff is universal Jewry. It can be seen this way. If you don't want to see it this way, well, you're not going to. But it can be seen this way, that underneath it all is universal Jewry and what universal Jewry wants. It doesn't matter what it's called, see, whether it's called communism or imperialism. When it's the Jews behind it, it all points toward the same aim, and they might bring in one or bring in another or bring in what's called democracy and so on, and freedom, and bringing whatever they bring in, they're still working, they're using it to achieve the same aim, which is establishment of Jewish power, whether, you know, under a monarchy, an empire, or a republic. So, this is the message that most of us understand already, but this is what is what the protocols are saying. And when they come out, the Jewish distractors come out and say, oh, it's just trying to make out this crazy thing that there's this big Jewish conspiracy to take over the world. They make it sound, that makes it sound like it's kind of nutty, you know, and it can't be serious. It can't be real. What kind of people are these that believe such things? But when you look at it the way it was actually working, particularly in France at that time, and where it has worked, you know, in so many other places, that's exactly what it boils down to. So in this one thing I'm reading, it said that in Gentile life, to Gentiles, you know, there's an unbridgeable abyss between conservatism and anarchy. You know, you can't be conservative and believe in anarchy at the same time. They're just mutually exclusive. And there's an abyss between religion and atheism. You can't, you know, you can't preach atheism and preach religion both. But there's no such chasm in the Jewish mentality, this writer says. There, all currents, no matter in what direction they may seem to flow, are finally united and channeled in one unique direction. That is, what's good for the Jews? What's going to take the Jews where they want? That's all that matters. Everything else, there's, you know, these so-called political positions and philosophies and so on don't matter, because they use them all to and think about a world conspiracy to take over the world. Okay, why it's not crazy? Because the Jews have always felt that unless they control everything, they will lose their control. They won't be strong enough because there are not very many of them, and they don't even want to grow. They like being a small group, exclusive. So their philosophy has always been, or their belief, that they have to control everything, and that's what they aim for. And we can see it. We can see how they do it in the media. Whatever they get into, they want to take it all over, and what they don't, what they show, Shabbos goys, you know, in positions that they put them in, but that's only so that you can't see clearly that it's all Jews. They say, oh no, it's not all Jews. But they're running it all, and that's their goal. And the protocols say that once they get everything in place and get all that done, then it'll all be out in the open, and they'll have their single ruler, the autocrat, and everyone will have to do what they're told. And well, I'm reading, there's just a lot you can read in there that explains and tells you what you can expect from all of this. Now, here's where it says again, I'm going to repeat, the Masonic activities of Adolf Krimiu. He belonged to the Lodge of Mizraim. He belonged to the Scottish Rite and also the Grand Orient. And he was in the Supreme Council of the Order of Mizraim. And at the death of this Jewish leader called Vianney, Frenchman, French Jew, he is the one who had united the Grand Orient and the Scottish Rite. Krimiu succeeded him as Grand Master of those two united lodges, which was huge, you know. So Krimiu was one of the most important Jews, one of the most influential, and considered one of the most brilliant of that time. So, and his efforts were directed against the Empire and against Napoleon III. And he consorted with all the emperor's enemies, among them Maurice Joly. And after Napoleon III was overthrown, Krimiu once more took an open part in the political affairs of his country. Now, let me just say this. At a general assembly of the Alliance Israelite Universelle on May 31st, 1864, Krimiu had said, "The Alliance is not limited to our cult. It voices its appeal to all cults and wants to penetrate in all the religions as it has penetrated into all countries. Let us endeavor boldly to bring about the union of all cults under one flag of union and progress. Such is the slogan of humanity." So, you know, what does that sound like to you? He says, "We want to penetrate all cults," meaning religions, "and as we penetrate into all countries, and let's bring about this union of all." They try to make it sound like it's something for humanity, just like the Holocaust people and Elie Wiesel and all that. Everything they do is for humanity. You know, Holocaust and humanity, or Elie Wiesel's foundation. What is it? Foundation, but it's for humanity. I mean, it sounds so stupid to say that, but they use that word all the time so that they will distract people from thinking that it's for Jews. No, it's they say they just want to help humanity. But they want to bring what they want to do. What this means is the doom of Christian civilization, the destruction of nationalism, and the death of nations. So this is what it's all about. And what I have tried to show you as a possibility, something to think about, as far as the protocols go, is that there is a great similarity between the protocols and this pamphlet by Jolie about the dialogues between Machiavelli. Machiavelli represents what they wanted people to think of. Think Louis Napoleon III represented, but in the protocols, this type of thinking and talk, personified by Machiavelli in the dialogues, is attributed to the person who's speaking and to the general goals that these people have, and they're not named, of course, but they do in a few places call themselves Jews, and they're always talking about the Goyim and the Goys and so on. So it's clear, you know, what it's about, what it is. And in this case, I think there's a very good case for saying that that Jolie was friends with Crémieux. Crémieux had access to the protocols. Either he wrote them or he worked on them, or they were in his keeping. And he allowed Jolie to use them in order to get this thing written that he wanted to get written against Napoleon III. And so Jolie used some of these arguments without concern that the source that he took them from, the protocols, would ever be seen by anyone. And this is why it's so upsetting to the Jews that they came to light, and why I believe that this story about this Russian woman, Glinka, is the correct story, or close to it, and it's more convincing to me than the story put out by the Jewish the establishment that is working to help the Jews, you know, cover this up and call it a forgery. And that's where I am today, ladies and gentlemen. About at the end of the program here, I'm going to see what I can come up with after this. But I'd like to hear from any of you who have listened to this, and what you think of it, and what kind of ideas you have, and how important, if you think it's important or not. I think it's very important, because I don't think there's any documents that have the effect on us and tell us as much as the protocols do. So thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. Be here with Hans Stoffel next week. So come and join us again. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.